Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to another week of the podcast. This week, I interview Rosemary Carroll. And as she came up on the Zoom screen, you know, I was interviewing her on a 105-degree day here in Santa Fe, and I could see through the window of where she was at that it was green, that it was lush, and it was raining. And it turned out that she was in Oregon, and she was on the Oregon coast. And before we began recording the episode, I told her about this really incredible experience I had in Manzanita, Oregon. I woke up one day and the entire town was just covered in fog. And so I made my way down to the beach, and Manzanita has one of the longest beaches on the western side of the U.S. and it just goes on forever. It's a huge beach, but you could not see the waves, you could not see the ocean. It was so thick. Stepping off the road and onto that beach was like walking into another world. And I did it. I did it. I walked toward the ocean. I could hear the waves, but I was held in this really thick pea soup fog. I couldn't see other people. Seagulls weren't flying because nobody had any visibility. And it was like being in this enchanted and magical space for a while. And the reason I bring that up is because I talk about it a little bit later in the episode. So I just wanted to clarify that before we started. Rosemary is an enchanting human being, and there is no two ways about that. She's a performance artist, a poet, a writer, a dancer, a choreographer. She's just this really intensely dynamic human being. And guess what? She brings up one of my favorite subjects, Sasquatch. This past summer, she traveled with her partner, Bette, up to Oregon. But along the way and along that journey, they made all of these friends in the Sasquatch community. It was part of this performing arts piece, and as a result, she created this really fabulous video called Interpretive Dances for Sasquatch, which I was lucky enough to see in person. I just love this human because she has such hope for the world and for the people in it. And she also has this really deep well of creative energy that shows up in really unexpected and delightful ways. So now, episode 133, and my interview with Rosemary Carroll.
I remember being a kiddo and peering out and seeing all kinds of holy processions going by, men, you know, wasted saints dragging boulders from their pinky or their testicles or on a bed of nails, and just absolutely beautiful, beautiful processions. And there I was in boarding school. And my friend Shekinah was a miracle to me. And I am just now realizing that it is possible Shekinah might have been an imaginary friend. I am Rosemary Giguere Carroll, daughter of John and Elaine, granddaughter of Mary and Lucille, great-granddaughter of Mary Crawford, Mary Carroll, Melvina, and my other great-grandmother, whose name I forgot. I am a self-produced creator. I'm a self-produced God over everything, a self-produced divine child of the spirit. And I asked to be given mind, and mind appeared and glorified me. And I asked to be given dance, and dance herself appeared within my body and produced herself upon the earth.
I love that. I haven't had very many people introduce themselves through their ancestors. I've never heard of the name Melvina before. That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's my mom is French Canadian, Quebecois. Grew up speaking French with her sisters, but we didn't speak French. in our family, and so that's a French Canadian name.
Yeah, it's actually, I was going to ask, because when you introduced yourself, you had a really unusual middle name. Is that a family name?
Yeah, that's my mom's maiden name, Giguère, G-I-G-U-E-R-E.
It is beautiful.
Thank you. I know, Bette might take it. Bette might take my middle name, Bette Giguère Williams.
That's amazing. Does it mean anything?
I don't know what it means, although I'm sure it means something. I do know that it's a family from Normandy. And I had always thought of myself as first generation because my mom's from Quebec and my dad's from Ireland. And then my mom and dad were at a church in Normandy and they found the ancestors. Here's the cat at the place I'm staying. Very cuddly cat. They found a plaque. They like trace ancestry in this meow place in Normandy. And the Giguères were some of the first people to go to Canada, like a male ancestor. And so that sort of shifted my perspective because Canada also is a colonial project. And so I was like, oh, okay. I go way back. It may be up north, but I go way back in the Giguère side.
That's so cool. You know, I think ancestors are so interesting and important, and they have these really fabulous stories to tell. You know, if we investigate the history and the genealogy. So did you grow up in Canada or where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rhode Island, mostly Rhode Island and the Providence Plantations, although they changed the state name, I think, 2 years ago and took out Providence Plantations, thank God. On a seaside town, small town, and then also the North Shore of New England, north of Boston. It's where I mostly grew up.
Why did your family decide to move there?
My grandparents worked in the mills on my mom's side, north in like Marlboro and Lowell and stuff. And then my father and his family came here. They took a boat. They came through Toronto. I don't know why. Oh, my cousin Jack on my dad's side lived in Lynn, Massachusetts. Lynn, the city of sin, never come out the way you went in. And it's a big, South Boston has a big Irish population. And so, yeah, they followed the fam.
I was going to ask you, you know, when you were a kiddo, did you think or did you imagine that you were going to become a dancer or an artist or what did you think when you were a kid?
Well, I was a dancer and an artist as a kid. Did I think for myself? I'm not sure I thought for myself, although it's been a lifelong quest to think for myself. I'm still working on that. I went through a phase wanting to be a vet because I love animals. If you could see me right now, which some of you can, I'm holding a kitty in my lap. Yeah, I've always known I was a dancer and that's what I would be.
Yes, and I've been so fortunate and lucky enough to see you perform a few times now, and I love it. It's always surprising. It's always dynamic. It's always so interesting and provocative and just a delight. You know, was there ever a time when you thought to yourself, I don't know, were you always this brave?
Brave. No, I think that came when the Disney movie came out and there was this beautiful red-haired girl named Brave. And I would walk down the streets and all the little kids would be like, Mommy, it's Brave. And then I was like, oh, I'm brave. Yes, it is. It's Brave. I have arrived. Before that, I was just a cowboy. Mommy, look, a cowgirl. Pink boots. Yes. I'm a cowgirl, pink boots. Yeah, I think we're all brave to live our lives every single day. To be a little girl, a little boy, a little creature in this culture, to step outside and use our imagination to say, oh, I'm growing. I can feel myself grow. How do I carry myself forward as a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, 18-year-old, young adult, middle adult, elder adult? How do I feel myself now? And what do I do next? I think that's very brave. So yes, I think I've always been brave. And I think you are too.
Thank you. You know, I've always had this issue, and I've talked about it before, with speaking in public. I detest it. I've gotten a little bit better, but it is absolutely terrifying for me. And you're kind of this wonderful inspiration because you don't seem to have that fear. And not only that, you're also combining the public speaking with art and dance and movement. And it, you know, my brain shuts down just trying to speak in public. I can't imagine, you know, accompanying it with all this other stuff. So it's a good thing to watch you and be inspired.
I am afraid. I have incredible stage fright. My mom told me, I forget, one of the like major actors she loves has stage fright. And so she was just like, Rosemary, it might never go away. So it's something that I work on. I work on, I practice saying what I want to say, and I listen to myself, and then I rephrase it. And I practice doing things in front of other people. And then I track how my nervous system responds, and I try and work with that. And it's incredibly slow moving sometimes, but I find it does at least give me tools and skills and craft and facility, which are just like some of the underpinnings of performance. Like, I knew I wanted to dance. I didn't know that that meant that I had to then do it on stage, and that then to carry that forward, I would make my own work.
And I think, and please forgive me if I'm wrong, but you've done some work with Judy Chicago. Is that true?
Yeah, last summer, Judy created a version of a project she had done in Cal Arts in 1972 with Miriam Shapiro and a group of artists that were at the time college level artists. And they did that in Los Angeles, and it was called Woman House. And so we did that in Berlin, New Mexico, took over a period home artists from across the state of New Mexico, and Nancy Yodelman, who was one of the original artists alongside Judy, and Miriam and Karen LeCoque came, and we did that. And so I was one of the visual artists that had a room, and my room was the outdoor space, and my visual art was my choreography. And then also performance art was a major part of just the whole art world in the 1970s, and also Woman House in the original 1972 Woman House. There was a big living room, and on Friday nights they would have performances, and they were developing all kinds of interesting work in that context and in other contexts around Los Angeles at that time. And so Judy did two contributions as well. She redid her menstruation bathroom over at her facility through the Flower Art Space in Berlin, and then also did a performance evening. And so, as well as my visual art installation, choreography, Crisscross Manifesto in Motion, I did two performance pieces in Judy's evening show. That was Hairy Testimony and Take Her Down.
Well, I'm so curious. Did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like?
I think I grew up in an agnostic and atheist household, which I view as religious. My parents are academics, and the underlying premise of that is intellectual and creative freedom. And it's also has its institutions, like academia is a major institution of the atheistic faith. the scientific method is a major underpinning of religious model. And so that was pretty prevalent for me growing up. I found religion, again, because atheism, one of the underpinnings is intellectual freedom, and there's a great worship of like the written word and knowledge and thought and ontologies and research methodologies. I found my way to religious doctrine very early, first with Buddhism and Hinduism in middle school, and then I found Unitarianism and goddess worship and things like that in high school. And then just let all of that kind of like slip away. And then also my mom and my parents are in people of the land. So we took care of the land. We had rosemary plants on the doorway. I was named after a plant. We cared for plants. We cared for the forest and the ocean, and had great respect for our own traditions and foods and language. My grandmother spoke Irish to me. There's a great faith in the people's ways in my household, and that has never been lost and will continue on despite the institutions. I have language around that is very different than my parents' language around that, but like for me, that's like maybe paganism, but my dad like eschews that word because of the history of Catholicism and paganism in Ireland, or like dirt worship, you know, that's too hokey for him. But for me, that's sort of what's happening.
Thank you so much. That's interesting. I really love that phrase, the people's ways. You know, it's so beautiful. And I've not heard that before, but your answer is so eloquent. So thank you. I appreciate it. I love that you grew up with academics for parents. That creates such a rich household, I think, for discussion, for dialogue, for inquiry, for, you know, having a huge imagination and following it wherever it leads, at least to me, I think. But I also really appreciate that your grandmother spoke Irish. I think that's really beautiful. So it's, you've had quite a really close kind of experience or history with the past, you know, with your grandmother speaking Irish, for keeping that alive and extant in the family. I just think that's beautiful. You're so lucky.
Thank you. I wanted to say a little something about academia, which I'm very grateful for. And I do believe that its like purpose of preserving and furthering knowledge has a great benefit to our culture, and that those institutions, which go back to the founding of various civilizations, problematic as they may be, are like, you know, have great, great tools and technologies within them. I did feel like I pursued higher education under the premise that it would offer me an opportunity of intellectual freedom. And I did not find that to be the case. I found that because of the overarching doctrine of atheism in the academy, that in fact, there was a lot of taboo and stigmatized thought, a lot of taboo and stigmatized methodologies, whole areas of approaching knowledge that were not allowed or just couldn't be written about, and that the forms that are accepted are so limiting that while that can be a great, great experience and tool to have those fine limitations, that it doesn't actually fulfill its promise as a space of intellectual expansion, knowledge keeping.
I have heard this before.
Yes.
This is not a surprise. Yeah. Thank you for that, because I think that also needs to be clarified. And it's confounding, because I think that institutions of learning, and they think, oh, we're the place of intellectual freedom and thought. And then when you get in there, you know, an institution is comprised of many different people, quite a few of the professors, they're very rigid in their belief system. And it's hard to kind of have open dialogue or open supposition around lots of different topics. So yeah, I get it. Thank you for telling me that. I like it. And I agree.
Well, I feel like everyday life has a lot of miracles. So it's hard to narrow this down. But I would love to talk about two things. The first being my current project, which is interpretive dances for Sasquatch. And for me, the Sasquatch peoples entering my life have been a profound miracle that is just beginning to unfold. And that miracle is in synchronicity and the mundane and the paranormal meeting the mundane. And it's tearing down for me all kinds of suppositions I held that may not have been serving my highest self. I was invited by Ashley Stinnett, who was more so inviting my 100% beloved woman of my dreams, who I think was also on this podcast, Bette Williams, who's another artist and writer who is my one and only. And Ashley Stinnett invited us, because she personally knows Bette, to come out to Oregon and write poetry for Sasquatch. And I was stuck in my tracks and dumbfounded. And I was intrigued and excited. I especially like the word for, because that felt like it was in devotion to something. And that is something that I feel like devotion is a huge part of my dance practice and my making. And I thought, I can do something for Sasquatch. I mean, all that conversation we had earlier about audience, imagine doing some work for a forest being, either a cryptoid who's alive and covered in hair and peering out, or an energy force field. Because some people think of Sasquatch as zoological and actual material, and others feel like Sasquatch comes as a healing energy. And I feel like both are possible, and in my experience. But I was hesitant. I even bargained. I even said, you know, if we're gonna go all the way out to Oregon, the Pacific Northwest, the land of healing mossy forest and oceans, and go instead to like the high mountains inland and devote our summer work to this thing, then we're going to have to cut a deal. And when I want to go to New York City and dance, or wherever with my weirdo friends and dance, we have to say yes. If we're going to travel to Oregon for Sasquatch, we're going to go to like Finland for contact improvisation or some obscure bullshit. But I was so wrong. As that very day that we started, that we said yes, my whole life changed. My prayer circles changed. My relationship with the world around me, my relationships with my family, we are closer, me and Bette and our dog Rosie. It's just been profound, and it's, there's Sasquatch leaves signs everywhere, and they can easily be missed, like in pebbles or rocks, and to start to see in like the dirt my pathway unfolding and being seen before me. So Sasquatch is also taboo in like almost every like religious or folk people have like a hairy forest being, but to actually mention it is taboo, even if we're talking about like an earth-based religion. Like, it can be very taboo to say, I actually believe in Sasquatch or Bigfoot or the abominable snowman. And then I find almost everybody I talk to has had an experience with Bigfoot. So many people that here I am thinking I'm doing this weird like internet meme, and actually Bigfoot has impacted the lives of my dearest community by showing up on their land, leaving gifts for them, singing songs for them, drumming with them, appearing in dreams, giving a sense of awe and wonder in the everyday, a sense of comfort in the forest, a sense of synchronicity in the city when you're at a carnival and the ride is Bigfoot and you think, oh, here I am, I'm from Maine and I'm okay here in Baltimore. Look, there's a Bigfoot pinball machine.
I love that. I actually interviewed a local artist here who used to do all the t-shirts. Maybe he does still, for Harry's Roadhouse, Joel. And his story for the podcast was about his two experiences with seeing Sasquatch. And, you know, he hasn't had any since. I understood it. Both these things happened when he's quite a bit younger. But, you know, they've certainly informed his art and his painting and his creativity ever since then. And, you know, in the second story, he said he was driving along a road and I believe he said that all these sheep and stuff started just running out of the forest in front of his car. You know, so he slowed down to avoid the sheep. And then he looked in his rearview mirror and this big kind of furry forest creature came out of the woods chasing the sheep. And he said, and then it just disappeared, or it melted into. And I thought, oh my goodness, maybe there's an alternate dimension that's just filled with Sasquatch.
Yeah.
And, you know, every once in a while they bleed through. But that certainly explains, you know, the blessings that all your friends are getting and the gifts and the drumming and the singing, you know, as if these creatures can come through every once in a while and bestow blessings on us. I think, you know, hearing these stories and understanding the experiences of others allows us to understand just a little bit more about the magic in the world or the potential that's out there for mystical or magical experience or experience that is potentially otherworldly. You know, it just always goes back to that, the theme, which is that there's more going on here than we can, you know, with our literal logical minds comprehend, that it's in a different space. Almost like when I went down to the beach, right? And there was that fog bank on the beach. It's like, you know, I could have avoided it, but it, you know, I walked into it. And when you're surrounded by such thick fog and you have no sense, you can't orient, you have no idea where you are, you can't see anything, you can hear the waves, so you know where the ocean is, but even your footsteps are lost because it's so thick. You're kind of, I sort of intentionally walked into this kind of in-between place when I was on the beach.
That's so amazing, Kirsten. It sounds like the creative process, sort of, you know, where am I? What am I doing? Keep walking.
Yes, but don't walk into the ocean. I was like, I gotta be smart about this. I just love synchronicity so much. It's just woven into the warp and the weft of this reality, at this universe. And, you know, it's to have it called forth or brought forth into notice in your life is kind of this really beautiful thing, but not everybody has the capacity to recognize it. You know, not everybody has the language or the understanding or the comprehension, even the willingness to say, hey, there's more going on here. Like, there's a trail of breadcrumbs that will lead us either into the forest or out of the forest, depending on the way we want to go. And I always wish for more people to see the breadcrumbs and follow them. Well, I know earlier when we were talking, you said you had two stories you wanted to share. So do you want to share the other one?
I mean, do we have time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I had a miraculous friend when I was 10 and 11, and her name was Shekinah. And we were living briefly in India. And I spent one semester at a boarding school there, just one half of the year, at a Christian boarding school, a former missionary school with still some Christian underpinnings. And it was the Kodi Canal school. And Kodi Canal is a holy place in southern India on top of a mountain. It's very astounding. There's pilgrims and ceremonies and holy days constantly. And I remember being a kiddo and peering out and seeing all kinds of holy processions going by, men, you know, waisted saints dragging boulders from their pinky or their testicles or on a bed of nails, and just absolutely beautiful, beautiful processions. And there I was in boarding school. And my friend Shekinah was a miracle to me. And I am just now realizing that it is possible Shekinah might have been an imaginary friend or a divine friend. I realized in some reading I was doing a few months ago that Shekinah is the name. It's a holy Hebrew word, and it's a holy word in Hindi, and it means the bodily manifestation of God. And that just struck a chord in me, because when I was in boarding school, and I'm so grateful for that time I had a little bit of a difficult time. I was scalded accidentally by boiling water or near boiling water. My face was fine, but I was covered in third degree burns on the back of my neck and back. It was also my first experience with like homophobia, I guess, in a direct way. Like my very first night, they had taken some of the boy children up onto a stage and were beating them. I was 10 or 11, so I think I was prepubescent, right? So my miracle is my friend Shekinah in boarding school when I was in India. So in my memory, Shekinah was a day student, and she lived in the forest with her auntie. And we were allowed to go out into the forest together and play in the forest. And we would sing and dance. After, we would observe berries. We would look at the color of the berries and the leaves. And we would look at the wood, the swirls in the wood, and the ground, the moss and the wood chips. And then we would sing and dance. And I'm not sure we shared a language. I'm not sure we shared English or Hindi. And occasionally we would go to Shekinah's auntie's house, and we would sit at a table, and it would be dark and cool, and we would sit. And the table was wood, and the house was wood, and we would maybe have a bit of tea. And she was my best friend. And I think I might have tried to write her some letters. Like I wrote my other friends some letters, Xenia and Sonia. And I'm now realizing that Shekinah might have been a figment of my imagination. She might not have been, but she might have been. Because I wasn't allowed out of the grounds of the school. So architecturally, it's possible that I was gifted a bodily manifestation in the form of a woman, a girl child, who brought me song and dance and color and form and quiet, that Shekinah herself visited me and took me to the forest and showed me myself and showed me God.
Yeah.
That's it, my interview with Rosemary. I know, I am totally crazy about Sasquatch and also the Loch Ness Monster and UFOs and ghosts, you name it. I kind of want to hear about it, which is why I do this podcast. I never know what the guests are going to say to me, so I was particularly delighted when Rosemary chose, as one of her miracles, Sasquatch. I need to thank Rosemary for sharing her stories and her time. And there will be a link to her website and that video, Interpretive Dances for Sasquatch, on the Treasures page of the Bite-Sized Blessings website. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode. Fat Sounds, Justin Allen Arnold, Electa Studio, Music L Files, Taiga Sound Productions, and Frank Schroeder. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to all sorts of groovy artists, to books, to music, to art, many, many items I hope lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Rosemary. Live in the realm of imagination. Live with the possibility that magic is out there, that it's hiding in the forest, that it's waiting for you to have a relationship with it and check it out. Be like Rosemary and delight in being a child again, in being playful, in being enchanted with the world. I, of course, love being that way, so I encourage all of you to be like Rosemary and engage your child self. Have fun. Do something silly. Laugh more. So be like Rosemary. Laugh more and find delight in the world.